You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots, solar-powered, community-supported radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. If you're listening on Monday, good morning. And we hope it's as nice a day then as it is today.
That's for sure.
And yeah, we have dodged the bullet so many times. Storms, you know,
they've been around us. That's we've great. Had really not a bad winter this year at all.
Nope.
And excuse me, but there's still a lot of cold
it's
flu
only,
going around.
It's the end of February. I know. That's what everybody keeps telling me.
Yeah. So, Mom, why don't you tell us what we've got in store for us today on Writers' Voices?
Well, I'll tell you, it's really interesting, and it's a book that everyone should read and give yourself some time because it's,
hard to put down.
It's hard to put down. That's right. And our our author is Kate Hamer. Hamer, and she's a winner of the Rhys Davies Short Story Prize. The Girl in the Red Coat is her first novel. It is a finalist for both the Costa Rica Novel Award and for the Dagger Award.
I think that's the Costa First Novel Award.
Costa First, sorry.
Yeah.
And she lives in Cardiff, Wales, with her husband and two children. Is that where she's calling from?
I'm not sure. Are you calling us from Wales today, Kate?
I am, yes. I'm in Cardiff today.
Oh, my goodness. How wonderful.
Well, welcome to Writers' Voices, and thank goodness for the miracles of modern technology.
Amen. Now, this novel is...
Thank you so much for asking me to be here.
This novel is set in...
Mostly England.
England, yeah.
Partly in America.
Well, yeah, so it makes it, well...
Well, Kate, tell us a little bit about your history as a writer.
Well, in terms of that, it's been quite a long journey, to be honest. I was very lucky to grow up in a bookish household, and my mother was a second-hand book nut, and she used to bring home all kinds of old children's books. So I grew up with sort of Victorian children's tales, like Charles Kingsley's The Water Babies, Alice in Wonderland, Treasure Island, all that sort of thing. And I wrote from probably quite a young age. I was always making up my own little books that I used to illustrate and staple together with stories. So that urge was there from pretty much the get-go. But then I always wrote, but I had a career, quite a long career in radio and television. I brought up a family, all this sort of thing. And it was really when my children left home that I thought, what is it I would really, really want to do with my life? And there was only one answer. And I signed up for a creative writing MA, and it kind of all went from there, really.
So how long ago was that?
I started the MA in late 2010. And the beginning of this novel, we were encouraged to do this thing that they called fragments, which I think is a really brilliant exercise, and I still do it now, actually. It's kind of writing a scene, which doesn't necessarily have to be a story or have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So you let your subconscious flow quite freely, I think. And the very beginning of this book started life as one of those fragments. And then it kind of all happened together, really. Winning the Rhys Davies Prize happened in 2011. So all this sort of writing that I'd done all these years, I think kind of once I put all my intentions on it, it just unfolded from there.
So it's sort of a overnight success that took decades?
Exactly. Very good way of describing it. Nothing comes everywhere, I say.
And but this book has garnered a lot of praise and a lot of attention. How does that feel?
Well, it's obviously very exciting, and it's lovely when people say nice things. And but you know, I think I'm writing my second novel now, and I think you've got to keep, as a writer, you've got to keep focusing on what you actually do, which is looking at the blank page every day. You know, it's not about sort of, I mean, all this is wonderful, but what you do for a living is kind of, you know, you think about the next thing and the next page and the next page and the next page. So I you know, it's been great. I'm not denying that, but I want to keep my feet on the ground at the same time.
Yeah. Well, it's probably a little bit hard to do, but you seem to...
Here, we're going to have to share a mic because that mic is not working. That's not working either. Okay, hold on. We've got some technical difficulties here.
Okay.
Okay.
That cord is under.
Yeah,
that's what's
okay. Doing. All right.
Okay. All right. Well, I would imagine that keeping focus is difficult, especially when, you know, this book took a long time, right? Wrong time to come to fruition. And so what is... What made you write this book? What was the impetus for this?
Well, I think it's a funny thing with, you know, the inspiration for books. It can sometimes feel like it's a bit out of the blue, and it certainly did with this book. You know, when I was encouraged to write one of these fragments, I was actually down... staying with my parents. They live in right in the middle of the countryside, and I was sort of in bed thinking about it, thinking what I could do for this exercise. And I'd had an image of a little girl wearing a red coat standing in a forest for a couple of weeks, you know, against, and I sort of knew in that image somehow that she was lost. And I sat up and I wrote the first chapter more or less straight off. And that was the kind of inspiration. That was everything unfolded from there. Quite shortly afterwards, I wrote the final paragraph as well. So I always knew where I was heading.
Oh, wonderful.
So maybe, yeah, and I've done, funnily enough, I've done the same with this book as well. I think it's emerging as just the way that I work. So, you know, I knew where I was heading. As a writer, I don't tend to plot very finely. I know people that have sort of Excel spreadsheets, and they do every little new plot point and everything before they even start writing. But I have probably like two or three major arcs, the first chapter and the last paragraph. And it kind of just really unfolded from there. And, you know, interesting that I'm talking to a program that's a mother and daughter, because really this book, that's the theme of it. That's the underlying kind of thing that propels it forward, is that relationship between mothers and daughters. And I wrote an article here last year for one of the British newspapers, because they were interested in knowing about sort of mother and daughter themes in literature. Once you start looking around, it's quite hard actually to find them. They're quite thin on the ground. I just found it a really potent, interesting relationship, and it's really that propels the novel. It's that relationship as much as anything else.
Now, Kate, obviously you have a mother. Do you also have a daughter?
I do, yes, I do. And a grandmother also features in this book. And I was very close to my grandmother too. Wow. And it's kind of those relationships that ripple down the years from one generation to the next that really interest me. You know, this particular book is mother and daughter. It's Mother Beth and daughter Carmel, and I wanted to show the relationship as a real relationship too. You know, they can be a bit scratchy with each other, a bit kind of, Carmel's only eight, but she's starting to, you know, push against the boundaries a little bit and be a bit sarcastic with her mum, as kids do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it's that relationship kind of is propels everything, I think.
But this child is a very unusual child. I mean, she's very complex.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, Carmel, and that's the other seed of it, really. Carmel's a strange child. I mean, it's from the outset that you see that she's not quite, you know, not quite the norm. She's dreamy. She's got quite a strong interior life of her own. Very, very sort of, you know, strong thoughts of her own.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of disappears. She goes off on her own as well, which sort of causes her mother a lot of anxiety.
Oh,
and
my, yes.
Heartbreak. And Beth is an anxious mother anyway, so this obviously makes it all the worse. But we find out later. It's a sort of hard book to talk about too much without
giving something away.
No, giving too many spoilers. But we find out that the once Carmel's taken to a storytelling festival and disappears for good, and Beth's worst fears are realised, we later on we sort of start to realise that the roots of this disappearance belong in that strangeness, and that's why she's been taken.
Well, of course, the mother keeps blaming herself, too, you know, and she, because of her anxiety, former anxiety, she keeps thinking, was it my fault? You know, was it my fault?
And of course you would.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Was it hard to write about, you know, having your child abducted is every parent's worst nightmare. What was it like writing from that space, from that fear?
Do you know what? I think writing's to a certain extent, I think people do write about their worst fears, and is it a way of exorcising them in some way? I'm not sure, actually, but I've heard other people talking about this. I don't think I could have written it when my children were young.
Mm.
They, you know, they've all flown the coop now very, very happily. But I do think there's something in it that people explore their anxieties and their fears through writing, and I know that was certainly the case with this. I kind of possibly chose quite an unusual tack with it, in the sense that people always say, did you research it very heavily and real-life cases and all that? I made quite a conscious decision at the beginning that I didn't want to do that. And it was for a couple of reasons, really. The first thing was I wanted this to be their journey. It's their story, you know, all of that sort of thing. But also, I didn't want to sort of paste terrible news stories onto fictional characters, and I wanted to sort of keep a bit of a separation between the two. Maybe a bit of a respect thing, I think, that, you know, I didn't want to trawl through details of you know, terrible things that have happened to people and use it in my my fictional work. So it was definitely, you know, it wasn't easy to write, but I do think there is something about writing where you explore what you're really afraid of.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kate Hamer, who's calling us from Wales. She's the author of The Girl in the Red Coat, which has been compared to, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Gone Girl, Girl on the Train. Do you feel like those comparisons are apt?
I don't the fact that there's a girl.
There's a girl and there's something scary that happens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a funny one, actually, because with the title, you know, it's a couple of people, it's been suggested, you know, that the girl title's a good one to use because it's so popular and all this sort of thing. And that maybe that's, but for me and for the publisher, actually, I think it was the opposite. So the publisher was a little bit worried about using yet another girl.
Mm.
Did go through lots of alternative titles. But we just came back to this one, actually. And I don't think it's the girl that's the important thing in it. I think it's probably the red coat, which I think is a really potent and, you know, strong image. And that's why the title stuck. But yes, yeah, there's been a lot of girls around these last 3 or 4 years.
Well, I think that, yes, besides the fact that the girl in the title, it also refers to the element of suspense and how that is captured on the page, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's in terms of the fact that it's been called a psychological thriller, yes. I mean, you read to find out what happens at a most fundamental level. But it's sort of, you know, genre is a funny thing as well. I didn't write thinking it'll fit into a certain genre. I wrote the story that I really, really wanted to write. And I think publishers will decide for you then where they think it fits in.
Kate, do you read psychological suspense yourself?
Yes, I do, but not exclusively. You know, I don't tend to read a lot of crime either, and it has been called a crime book, which it is in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly quite an unusual crime book.
Oh, yes.
So my reading's quite wide, actually. And that is one category I like, but... No, a genre was never sort of very present when I was writing it at all, you know. And I think there's a lovely thing with your first novel is that you write and actually you don't have to worry about all that sort of thing because nobody knows what you're doing. You're kind of, you know, which is difficult but also has its good side as well because I think it frees you up to write and not to worry too much.
And of course, once you've had success in a genre, it can be difficult to break out of that. Is your next book also in this vein?
I would say it probably is in a similar territory, but I think I've been very lucky with the publishers I've had. You know, maybe I've had a very good experience, I don't know, but I haven't really had any pressure at all to go one way or the other, and they've been very, you know, generous, and I've actually had quite a rosy experience, I think, this, when, you know, you hear about other people's experience with publishing and the kind of pressure that's been put on them. Actually, I found it all quite supportive and positive. So
now the U.S. version is being published by Melville House Publishing.
That's right.
That's a new name to me. Can you tell me a little bit about them?
It's an imprint of Random House, Penguin Random House. And I think they're probably quite similar. In Britain, it's published by Faber and Faber. And I get the feeling that they have quite a similar profile, that they're both very, you know, sort of quite independent in their vision, and not huge, not small either, but not a massive conglomerate. And, you know, I think that the experience I've had with people working in publishing is that, I mean, like me, they're just really passionate about books, and I think they've done a beautiful job on it, actually, and the cover, I think, is gorgeous. So I'm really pleased to be with them, and I think they suit the book very well, and I think the book suits them.
Excuse me. How did you find your publisher in the UK?
In the UK, I actually, the first step was to get an agent here. And mm-hmm. I think that's probably the biggest thing is once you find your agent, it's sort of their job to go out and look for the publisher. Finding an agent, it's finding somebody that's on the same wavelength as you, which I did, is really, really important, because I don't know quite how it works there, but here it's really common that you'll work on the book with your agent for a while before it even gets sent out to publishers. And then I know that she sent it to a variety of different people. And then it landed with Faber, which is I'm really happy about as well. It's a really well-established... They publish a lot of poetry. People like Ted Hughes, Seamus Heaney. One of the founders of it was T.S. Eliot. It's a really sort of solid...
So a literary...
And wonderful, wonderfully historic publishing house.
Well, Kate... A lot of authors say that getting an agent is actually the hardest part. Did you feel that having won the Rhys Davies Short Story Prize helped you in that process?
I think it really did, actually, and it helped me in all sorts of ways. I would encourage people, anybody that's writing, to enter literary competitions, because it does all sorts of things. I think the biggest thing, it just gives you that boost of self-confidence, which is perhaps I am actually doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
perhaps there is something there. And I think that's, as a novice writer, I think that's really important when you've been writing for years and sort of not particularly shared your work or anything like that. To have that kind of that happening to you is really important. But then also when you're approaching publishers and agents, it does help to have a prize like that under your belt. I think it sort of, maybe gives them a certain degree of comfort that you've got certain stripes to your elbow, sort of thing. I think for anybody writing, I would definitely say go in for competitions. It's a really good way forward. And you get to meet people. You know, we had a lovely dinner on the awards night. You get to chat to people that you wouldn't normally do. And, I would definitely say that very much helped.
Well, Kate, what did your children think of Mum going back to school, studying writing, entering contests, and getting published?
Oh, they take it all in their stride. They're just like, oh, what's she doing now? I don't think they sort of, I don't think they're sort of quite a wry look on it all, I think. Actually very proud as well now.
I'm sure. Was there any eyeball rolling when you announced you were going back to school to study for the MA?
No, maybe just an eye twitch.
But look what it's done. Now, do you have during the years when you were, had your career in radio and television, which I'd like to ask you about too, and raising your family, do you have books tucked away in drawers that you wrote during that time that you might bring out and try and revive?
I do have books tucked away. I don't think I'm ever going to bring them out. I think they're going to stay very, very firmly in those drawers. I think writing is just such an apprenticeship. You know, you almost do learn it, I think, by doing it, and it's a long, long, long process. It's, you know, there's a wonderful book. Have you read Stephen King's On Writing?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And I think that is such one of the greatest writing books, and I recommend it to everybody. And I go back and read chunks of it all the time myself. But it's that thing about being taught writing. I mean, I did go back to college and I studied it. But I think what they do is almost encourage you to write rather than teaching you to write. It's a funny thing. So, no, I have got work, but short stories. I mean, a lot of the short stories have been published in various anthologies. But I think the novels that I attempted then, they were my learning apprentice pieces. I think of them as, you know, bits of knitting. kind of, you know, go wrong in places.
Yes.
They've got frayed edges and all that sort of thing.
Right, and you could pull apart and redo that part, but it's never going to be as good as starting fresh.
Exactly, yeah. So, no, they're staying in the drawer.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kate Hamer, author of The Girl in the Red Coat, which is gripping.
Yes.
And, you know, we only had this book for about a week and a half. And so we didn't have time for, and we only had one copy, didn't have time for Mom and I to both read it completely. So she read the whole thing. I read about half, and now I have to finish it.
And I didn't tell her. I didn't tell her the ending.
She did not give away the ending.
I didn't spoil it.
But no. I have to know what happens.
Yeah. So let me ask you about the editing process. How did that go? Did you have did you do that yourself, or did you have someone else do it for the editing?
Actually, both. I tend to edit hugely over. I mean, I don't like to think how many times this book's been edited. It's just crazy, and that's partly why I'm quite fond of the first chapter. Is that it's actually more or less as I wrote it. It's not been edited very much at all. How many times would I have edited it before the agent saw it? I'm not sure. I mean, I tend to do this thing where I'm writing and to read over everything that I've written right from the beginning every day and edit, and it just gets more and more untenable the further in you get to into the book. When you're up to 60,000-70,000 words, you spend all day reading what you've done before. Uh-huh. So I try and be disciplined about not doing that and just read the chapters that I wrote the day before. But so I edited a huge amount before I sent it out to an agent. The agent worked with me again on it. And then I had a really wonderful editor at Faber called Sarah Savitt. And we probably worked for about 6 months on it. I mean, it's quite an exhaustive process, but she had a really great approach to it, because you worry about what's going to happen to your work, obviously, that somebody's going to want to change everything and, you know, make it all different. But it really wasn't like that. She had this way of doing it that she would ask questions about the characters and about what happens and their motivations. And I think by doing that, it kind of gets your brain ticking over then and thinking, well, you know, what is she thinking at this point? Or, you know, why is he doing that at this point? And what I found is it wasn't so much changing what happened in the book, because that really didn't happen at all. It was more about developing and pushing forward what was already there and making it more defined. And I found it a really interesting process, actually. I wasn't sure that I would, but afterwards I could see that it was a much, much better book through having gone through this process beforehand. And I learned a lot as well. I learned an awful lot.
I think if you're that for a writer to be successful, commercially successful, for sure, they have to be open to editing, because otherwise, you know, I have had writers say, oh, I don't want anyone to touch or change anything. And I don't think they're going to cut it, that's going to cut it in the
apparently not
world of publishing.
I think if it's somebody, the really important thing is to have somebody on the same wavelength as you. Obviously, if somebody was coming in and you didn't sort of value their ideas or what they were saying, it would be a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do really value what they're saying, I think shining that light on your work and asking really relevant questions, I think is really valuable. I think it was partly the fact that I'd worked in television, which is a collaborative sort of process anyway. So you would go away, you'd make a film or a documentary, and, you know, really, probably more quickly than in publishing, people would come in, executive producers and people like that, and put their input into it. And I think I was quite used to that already, that, you know...
That makes sense.
Have a critical eye coming in and saying, oh, well, maybe that needs tightening up a bit, or some music needs putting under that piece of dialogue, or, you know, so I think in a way maybe I was ready for it. It wasn't too much of a shock for me that the fact that, you know, it is collaborative. Once that first draft or the second draft is there, then other people will step in and start shining the light on it. And actually, I think it's a good thing. You know, I think you need to be able to do that, really.
So Kate, you were a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker, is that?
Yeah, I worked in television and radio, actually. Radio's lovely.
And BBC or somewhere else?
I worked for independent companies here. I didn't work on drama at all. It was always on documentaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that I'd just like to talk a little bit about the difference between filmmaking and writing a novel, because a lot of people go the other way. They write a book and then they want to make a film from it. And writing is at least in the beginning, a very solitary process, whereas filmmaking, it seems to me, is almost collaborative from the very, very beginning. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I would, actually. And I think maybe what I kind of got towards the end of what I felt I could do in documentaries. And I mean, I had some really interesting times, worked on really interesting projects, and I think I was just approaching this point where I thought, we're telling other people's stories here, and this is part of what you do as a documentary maker. You're kind of enabling people to tell their stories. And you know, I think I was coming probably quite towards the end of that, and I was feeling more and more that I just wanted to tell, I wanted to have the freedom to tell my own stories. But yes, I mean, it is day to day. It is quite different, and you know, you're on your own a lot more when you're a writer,
and you don't have to depend on other people.
Just occasionally, I think, because I used to work with crews, and there was always quite a lot of, you know, banter, and it's
camaraderie,
quite a good fun. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's quite a fun thing, you know. You go out with a crew of four, five, six people, Just occasionally, I think, you know, I think I do miss that occasionally.
Well, you could get together with other writers and write.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, no, actually, funnily enough, I am part of a couple of writers' groups, and we do meet up and chat, and which is really lovely, actually.
Kate, why don't you read for our listeners a section from The Girl in the Red Coat so they can get an idea for the feel of the novel?
Okay. I'll read this bit. It's the book is a dual narrative between mother and daughter, Beth and Carmel, and two very different voices, really. And I'll start with Carmel's voice. As I said, she's quite a funny little character, one that I sort of fell in love with. But she's certainly an individual, and this is very much towards the beginning of the book. And Carmel's picking up the story, and she's relating what happened on her birthday. For my 8th birthday, I want to go and see a maze. Carmel, what do you know about mazes? Mum says. If I think hard, I can see a folded puzzle in my mind that looks like a brain. I've heard things, I say, and Mum laughs and says, okay. We don't have a car, so we go on the bus, just the two of us. The windows are steamed up, so I can't see where we're going. Mum's got on her favourite earrings, which are like bits of glass, except colours sparkle on them when she moves. When we get off the bus, the sky is white, and I'm so excited to see a real maze, I run ahead. We're on this big park, and mist is rolling around in ghost shapes. There's a huge grey house with hundreds of windows that are all looking at us. I can tell Mum's scared of the house, so I growl at it. Sometimes she's scared of everything, Mum. Rivers, roads, cars, planes, what's going to happen and what's not going to happen. But then she laughs and says, I'm such a silly old thing. Now we're at the top of this hill, and I can see the maze below, and it does look like a brain. I think it's really funny I've thought about a brain inside my brain, and I try to explain, but I don't do it very well, and I don't think Mum really gets it. But she's nodding and listening anyway, and standing there with her long blue coat all wet from the grass at the bottom. She says, that's very interesting, Carmel, though I'm not sure she really understood. But Mum always tries to. She doesn't just ignore you like you're a mouse or a bat. So we go in. And I know, all of a sudden, it's a place I love more than anywhere I've ever been. The green walls are so high, the sky's in a slice above me. And it's like being in a puzzle, but in a forest at the same time. Mum says the trees are called yew, and spells it out, because I laugh and ask, yew? I run on ahead down the path, in the middle where the grass is squashed into a brown strip, and Mum's far behind me now. But it doesn't matter, because I know how mazes work, and that even if I lose her, we'll find each other sooner or later. So that's Carmel's voice, and I mean you can see already that she is a slightly, you know, a kind of slightly otherworldly little character.
Right. Although even more so, I think, than this section shows.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah, well, as it goes on, that becomes more and more apparent.
And she, of course, she knows how her mother feels about being separated, and yet she runs ahead, and which I thought was kind of interesting.
Well, I think that's sort of what you do. You kind of, it's a bit of a push me pull you thing, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
You want the safety of your parent like that, but you also push against the boundaries. You want your own freedom.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's, you know, the way that parent-child relationships often work. So it's a constant push-me-pull-you thing going on.
It's true, and it doesn't ever really end.
No, no, most definitely, no. I agree with that. it's a funny thing, you know, because they're so close to each other, yet they do have this thing going on, and actually, I think it's really natural.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. I, you know, because you are talking to a mother and daughter.
Yeah.
You know, I will say that as a daughter, I'd say my mother was sort of ideal for me because she was never really controlling.
Well, that's the way my mother was too.
Yeah. I think I was maybe a little more controlling with my daughter, so there's a little more push-pull between us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it takes a lot of confidence not to be controlling as well, because it's part of wanting to keep children safe. And, you know, so mothering is just not an easy thing at all. And to get it right, and also Beth is a single parent, so that kind of plays its role as well. So it's just the two of them. So they are kind of more on top of each other maybe than they would be in a kind of two-parent family.
That's a good point. Should we hear a little bit from the mother's perspective?
Yeah, sure. I'm just wondering which one to read out. Maybe I'll read a bit from the very beginning. This is the first chapter that I was mentioning.
Your favorite chapter?
I haven't gone over it exhaustively 50,000 times. Really. It sort of has quite a nice place in my heart. So I'll read a little bit of this out. So when I kind of had that first image of the little girl in the red coat standing in the forest and knowing that she was lost, when I actually came to writing this first chapter, it surprised me because it wasn't her voice straight away. It was the voice of her mum, and she's talking about missing her and remembering her. And we know something terrible has happened, but we're not sure what. So that this is how the book begins. I dream about Carmel often. In my dreams, she's always walking backwards. The day she was born, there was snow on the ground. Silvery light arced through the window as I held her in my arms. As she grew up, I nicknamed her My Little Hedge Child. I couldn't imagine her living anywhere but the countryside. Her thick, curly hair stood out like a spray of breaking glass or a dandelion head. You look like you've been dragged through a hedge backwards, I'd say to her. And she would smile. Her eyes would close and flutter, the pale purple vein lids like butterflies sealing each eye. I can imagine that, she'd say finally, licking her lips. I'm looking out of the window, and I can almost see her, in those tights that made cherry licorice of her legs at the lane to school. Tonight, I'll dream of her again. I can feel it. I can feel her in the twilight, sitting up on the skeined branches of the beech tree and calling out. But at night, in my sleep, she'll be walking backwards towards the house. Or is it away, so she never gets any closer? Her clothes were often an untidy riot. The crotch of her winter tights bowed down between her knees so she'd walk like a penguin. The school collar would stick up on one side and be buried in her jumper on the other. But her mind was a different matter. She knew what people were feeling. When Sally's husband left her, Sally sat in my kitchen drinking tequila as I tried to console her. Carmel came past and made her fingers into little sticks that she stuck into Sally's thick brown hair and massaged her scalp. Sally moaned and dropped her head backwards. "Oh, my God, Carmel, where did you learn to do that?" "Hush, nowhere," she whispered, kneading away. That was just before she disappeared into the fog. Christmas, 1999. The children's cheeks blotched pink with cold and excitement as they hurried through the school gates. To me, they all looked like little trolls compared to Carmel. I wondered then if every parent had such thoughts. We had to walk home through the country lanes, and already it was nearly dark. It was cold as we started off, and snow edged the road. It glowed in the twilight and marked out our way. I realized I was balling my hands in tight fists inside my pockets with worries about Christmas and no money. As I drew my hands out into the cold air and uncurled them, Carmel fell back, and I could hear her grumbling behind me. "Do hurry up," I said, anxious to get home out of the freezing night. "You realize, Mum, that I won't always be with you," she said, her voice small and breathy in the fading light. Maybe my heart should have frozen then. Maybe I should have turned and gathered her up and taken her home, kept her shut away in a fortress or a tower, locked with a golden key that I would swallow, so my stomach would have to be cut open before she could be found. But of course, I thought it meant nothing. Nothing at all. "Well, you're with me for now." I turned. She seemed far behind me. The shape of her head was set the same as the tops of the hedges that closed in on either side. "Carmel?" A long plume of delicate ice breath brushed past my coat sleeve. "I'm here." So that's from the first chapter. So we sort of find out quite soon that all is not well, really.
And you, so you knew that from the very beginning?
Yeah, I did. I kind of, it took me a little, not a long time, but a little while to sort of work out why and the whys and wherefores. But this was the very beginning of the whole, this was the seed of the whole book, really. This mother talking about her little girl in this way.
Did you ever find yourself depressed while you were writing this?
Oh, it's an interesting question, actually. Nobody's asked that before. I don't think so. No, I once I'd finished it, I've got a really, really old print of Little Red Riding Hood in my house, and I kind of looked up and I realized that I was sort of writing out a fairy story that I'd really loved as a child, because Carmel really is Little Red Riding Hood that's strayed off the path, and she's threatened by the wolves of this world. But I don't know that if you were being depressed by what you were writing, you'd be able to carry on. I think if I felt like that, I don't think I would have carried on. I think you're more compelled, I would say, would be a better word that I would use.
We had a guest a few months ago, and I don't remember which one right now, but he was writing something that was a very sad story, and he said at one point he had to Live Like Lyme. Love Like Ellen. Mm. And it was a true story, and he said he had to he had to stop for a while because he got bogged down in the sadness of it. Yeah. So you're right. I couldn't carry on.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's you say it was a true story, yeah?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I think maybe that's the difference. Uh-huh. Again, it's that thing of fiction takes things to a different place, it kind of it shows things in a different light, and I think I experienced that when I was working in documentaries, actually, that feeling very sad, but I never did working on a fictional thing.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. That probably does make the difference.
Yeah, you kind of I suppose you take things and you transform them in a way.
What were some of the documentaries that you worked on? Can you remember what some of the subjects were?
Yes. Yeah, I worked on lots and lots of arts documentaries. Really, really lovely sort of subjects. I worked on ones about Victorian pre-Raphaelite painters, which was really involved going lots around galleries in Britain and looking at paintings, which is never a bad thing.
Right.
There was that, and oh gosh, it seems quite a long time ago now, but yes, lots and lots of arts documentaries, and oh yes, a really wonderful one about the poet Wilfred Owen, where we went to France and actually sort of retraced the steps of the places that he fought in the First World War in France. That was really, really interesting, actually, and visited his grave. He was killed, I think, either the day before or 2 days before armistice was announced.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Yeah, I know. And we visited his childhood homes and filmed there. So I worked on. I was very lucky. Actually, I worked on some really interesting stuff.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kate Hamer, author of The Girl in the Red Coat. So, Kate, you know, I mentioned earlier that this book is being compared to a lot of very popular books like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Gone Girl, Girl on the Train, all of which have been or are being made into movies. Has there been any interest in making The Girl in the Red Coat into a movie?
Yes, it has actually been optioned, which I believe it's a funny system. I believe it means that they've bought the option to acquire the rights.
Right.
Complicated process.
So it's a few steps away from the.
It is a few steps away. I don't think it's plain sailing. It apparently this is how it's done. But so I mean that's very exciting as well. But you know, like I said before, I'm keeping my feet on the ground about that one too.
Hmm. With your experience in filmmaking, do you think you'll be involved in making this film?
Yeah, do you know, I went to an event yesterday with a writer, Renee Knight, who's written a book called Disclaimer, and that's been made into a film. And she actually worked in drama, and she's written the script for it. She's in the process of writing the script for it. I don't think I'd want to do that, actually. I don't know that I could. I feel it's such a different discipline. I think I wouldn't know where to start writing a film script. So if it does come about, I think I'd be very happy to leave it to the experts.
I think you're very smart.
Yeah.
So Kate, tell us a little bit more, if you can, about what you're working on now.
I'm probably on about the third draft of my second novel. It's a coming-of-age novel again, and it's the same but different, if that makes sense. It's got quite a healthy dose of the supernatural in it again. It's written in two time frames as well, which has been very interesting. Been very, very interesting.
Is it multiple points of view also?
It is, yes. And two time frames and two points of view. It's got a subtitle calling it the ghost stories. So it's kind of a modern ghost story, I would say.
Well, we've noticed that there seems to be a trend towards multiple points of view and multiple time Our guest last week, Michelle Gable's book, had like three different times going on, and and different points of view in each one. And from a reader's perspective, that can it can be more difficult to get into the story, I think, when it's jumping from one storyline to another. How is it from the writer's perspective?
Well, I think you've got to be really careful, actually, as a writer, because in a way you're kind of making, you know, it's you're making sometimes quite a hard job for yourself. Keeping it all, it's like juggling loads of balls in the air and keeping them all in balance, you know. And you don't want one story to overtake the rest. You want it to be clear. You don't want the reader to lose interest in one story and just want to skip to the other one. So I think for me that the fundamental of it is that they have to weave together in a really, really intrinsic way.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it doesn't work. But, I, you know, it's not the easiest thing to do for a writer. And I know this The Girl in the Red Coat is a dual narrative. And I think there's a wonderful naivety when you start off with your first novel, your first, you know, really serious novel, that you're not quite sure what you're biting off. And it's probably just as well because
it probably is, and I think you made it work actually better than most. Yeah,
thank you. And I do think it's one of the major. It is a major challenge in writing. So I think I'm looking forward to after my third one, which is also got different points of view, but the fourth one, what is going to be?
Oh, so you already have the third one planned?
Yes.
But you haven't started, have you started writing it?
I've written the beginning and I've written the very final paragraph. So that just seems to be the way of writing that's emerging for me very clearly.
Obviously.
It's the way that works. Well, Beth, or Kate, we are so happy to have you with us today, but unfortunately we are out of time. It's amazing how
thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
It's amazing how quickly an hour can pass when we're having a fascinating conversation.
It does, yeah. It does.
So stay tuned now for Planet Earth's Wild if you're listening on Friday, and this program will rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. And if you're listening on Monday, have a great week. And if you miss part of it, you can check it out on writersvoices.com in a couple of weeks. We'll get it up there. And, Mom, do you have some parting words of wisdom for us?
Well, yeah, I do, sort of. You know, there's that saying, the early bird gets the worm. Well, the moral of this story is really that it's better to be the early bird than the early worm. Goofy, I know.
Goodbye, Kate, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.